Welcome to another episode of the Kraken Backs. Today we're honored to have Mike Marotta as our guest. From serving his country in the Air Force to enforcing the law on our streets, and now as a fervent advocate with First Help, Mike has truly seen it all. His kaleidoscope of experiences informs his passion to support first responders and has gifted him a unique insight into a system he claims is fundamentally flawed. We'll be diving into these systemic issues as well as tackling the raw and personal stories of friends he's lost to the mental health battle. And on a lighter note, Mike will share his secrets to managing marriage amidst the chaos of life in high-pressure fields. This is going to be a heart-hitting and lightning episode you won't want to miss. So lean in as we crack open a new understanding of the first responder's world.
Mike, welcome to the show. We're totally happy to have you. And just to kind of set the stage, you have an incredibly diverse background. You served in the U.S. Air Force. Then you went to law enforcement. And now you're working with a company called First Help. How do these experiences intertwine? And how did they fuel your passion for supporting our fellow first responders?
I appreciate you having me on the show. First of all, so when I was young, it was tough, man, you know, young dad, young husband. And so I did what a lot of young folks do. And I said, you know what, I'm going to join the military. And I was super fortunate to have served as a C5A loadmaster. For folks who don't know in your audience, that is the largest airframe in the United States military inventory. We did a lot of really heavy logistics moving. Something unique that I did also when I was in, because President Bush was in office, our unit was tasked with hauling his limos and his agents. So it was just kind of unique that I got to haul around the limos from time to time and be part of that. And then because I was in the reserves and I spent my first few years on active duty, because of OEF and OIF, Iraqi Freedom and Enduring Freedom, I got to spend a lot of time flying. They kind of deactivated, orders started drying up, and I said, I need a job. And, you know, like so many military folks, I said, let me get into law enforcement. And interesting, I'm a second generation law enforcement officer. I'll be just perfectly transparent. The first generation of law enforcement in my family is the reason I was like, I'm never going to be a cop. And then ended up being a cop. Yeah. Yeah. I was like, I'm not going to be. That's look, me and my dad we're good now, but it was rough. And I just didn't want to be part of the business, the culture. And then I ended up doing it. I don't know. I'm sure there's some Freudian thing y'all can deconstruct there. Yeah. And so then I served for 16 years as a law enforcement officer in a large department here in South Texas. And, you know, I left after 16 years of doing that. A lot of people go, why at 16 years would you leave? Right. Because for so many of us as responders and military, it's like, no, I'm going to stick this out until I get some kind of reward or pension for having served. And for me, you know, the short answer is the values just no longer aligned with my life and how I wanted to live. So I left the business just shy of retirement. Everybody still gives me crap about it. You didn't want to get retirement? I said, no, man, somebody give me a reason beyond the retirement check of why I should stay here. Anyways, we could talk about that later. And then I was just super fortunate, a national nonprofit called First Help, founded by Karen Solomon. And the organization really is best known for a nationwide database that we have of suicides of first responders. And so they called and said, hey, we're budgeting for this position. What do you think? And I went, what do I think? I got no job. Let's do it. And So it's been a year that I've been doing that. And now, and I don't want to speak too far ahead, but I'm working on another job offer that I got out in Virginia. And so I'm traveling to Virginia at the end of next week for a few days to meet with the staff out there. So I'm really excited about that potential opportunity.
Yeah. Oh. You know, you mentioned a little bit about the system. And you and I have a connection with a person who took their life and in the law enforcement world and suicide. And you and I have talked on the phone, and you mentioned a couple of times that the system is broken as it currently exists. And, you know, I kind of want to engage this audience that, you know, we think of our first responders, cops, vets, firemen, as these heroes, and these, and yet they go home and they're a mental mess. And so can you talk about the system issues that are preventing first responders from receiving the help they need, and what needs to change from your inside perspective?
Ooh, man, that's a big question, you know, because what with that question comes the C word, and the C word is culture. And when you say culture, it scares people, because I think it feels a little bit of an like an attack for people, and it's not. This is just the way the culture has always been. Like, you know, there's this expectation of perfection among first responders and among the military. Like, you got to get it right all the time. People's lives depend on it. The country's freedom depends on it. There's no way you can be broken. You're the one who's supposed to be fixing it. No. And that's, we know that is absolutely not the truth. And so I challenge folks in leadership and also boots on the ground, like, do not police, do not serve, do not lead from a position of brokenness, because all you're going to do is perpetuate the culture. And we're trying to get on the other side of that. Like, how do we intend to grow beyond that culture, the culture of silence and fear and stigma and shame, and this idea that of like perfectionism, like, if I don't have it right, there must be something wrong with me. And there's this fear of judgment, and that people are going to say, well, you know, Mike, man, he said he can't handle that call. I don't want to make calls with that guy, when we should be going, that's the guy I absolutely want to make calls with, because he's in touch with how he's feeling and the discomfort that comes with seeing these things day in and day out. So like, I know I'm giving you a really long answer here, but to me, how you get through that, how you break through it, is you as leaderships within your agencies. Because here's something a lot of people don't know. There's about 18,000 law enforcement agencies, and I'm very kind of law enforcement centric, just because I served in law enforcement. There's about 18,000 law enforcement agencies in the United States. The average size is 10 to 12 officers. That is the average size of a police department in the United States of America. About a dozen officers. Wow. So you think about that. You know, if I got one or two folks and they say, man, I'm struggling. I mean, you got a sizable portion of your department that is mentally ill. And I'm just like, and so what? Like, big deal. Let's have the conversation. Let's identify who the people are that are willing to have the conversation. Like, let's break the barriers. Let's break the cultural norms and have these really difficult conversations. So to me, you want to change, you got as leadership, you got to identify who the folks are within your organizations, who people go to, because these organizations are full of informal leaders, people that the other men and women trust. Identify who they are, leverage their skills, build them up, give them training, and figure out how you can put them in a position to succeed and to change the trajectory of their department. Honestly. Yeah.
Mike, you know, we've all experienced people who've had, you know, friends or peers that have lost their lives or taken their lives, I should say. And, you know, can you share how some of these personal experiences have shaped your mission with First Help and some of your views on mental health amongst first responders?
Yeah, absolutely. So I left SAPD, and I probably shouldn't. Well, I left San Antonio PD last year, about March, April. After I left, there was a 6-month period where they had 6 suicides in a very short period of time. That was 6 in 6 months. And then if you went back about a year from that point, it was 8 because there was a 2 the year before. One was a supervisor. So like for me, here I was following this very like formative time in my life in 2019 and doing the work. You know, there was things that happened within the agency and I was like, I got to go. And then I left and this happened to friends of mine, you know, Doc, like we talked about on the phone, like friends we have in common. I mean, you're in California. I'm in Texas. Like this is how impactful this is. So I lost friends. I lost a really good friend of mine who sat in this house, in this living room on the couch that's right here in front of me, and promised me, Mike, I'm not going to do it. I'm not going to take my life. I gave my gun to a family. Like we're good. God. And then 3 days later, you know, he took his own life and not in the traditional way that you might imagine, but he did. And I remember thinking, man, I gave everything. I had resources. I set appointments. I did. I supported. And this still happened. And that just told me I can't fight 27 years of bad culture that had so deeply rooted in this man. So that's how it affected me. And it's still, man, I gotta live with those things and think about these guys and continue to live my life and do my job and take opportunities that will continue to honor them, because that's, for me, that's what it's all about.
Wow. Is there anything you do differently today because of those experiences? I mean, you're obviously learning more and more each time, but I also think it's kind of interesting. I wonder what goes on in that particular culture in that department or in that area of the world or country or state that there've been so many suicides, you know?
I don't want to get into bad mouthing the leadership or say it's broken, but clearly when you see that many suicides that closely together, there's something going on within the agency. And there also is a phenomenon called suicide contagion, which I'm sure you all are familiar with. And just this, you know, when there's someone who dies by suicide in an agency, a school, a family, a place of business, you got to be very vigilant that because the risk's high for everybody, you got to be vigilant that there may be another suicide right on the heels of that one. Because it's this idea of like, well, that was used as an option. That was a good friend of mine. So maybe this is also an option for me. And then also to answer your question, Doc, no, there's not anything I would do different. I loved him wholeheartedly and supported him. And I've come to the realization that you're not going to stop everybody. There's no amount of love, support, and hope you can infuse into some people are just, that's the decision they've made and that's what they're going to do. But, you know, I wouldn't change anything. I would love and support him exactly the same way, short of telling you're going to live with me for the next month. I mean, I don't know, beyond that, what I could have done, but, I still wonder, and I'm not looking for, when I look at the suicide numbers since 2016, I averaged it out from 2016 to 2022. When you break apart first responder suicides, you look at our database because we do a really good job of capturing those metrics. They're averaging about 200, 201 suicides per year among first responders since 2016 to 2022. That's an incredibly large number. I'm not looking for zero. There are people that say, we want zero suicides. And I said, man, I don't want to see zero, but I would love to see it a little bit less. That's my goal. Like, can we just reduce this just a little bit? I'm trying to figure that out. And I know there's a lot of really amazing people in the United States that are all trying to work together to figure out how to change the direction of this bad trend, you know?
So as long as you can walk away saying you did your best, you know, that's all that's important, you know, and it sounds like you've done it. I mean, what more could you do at some point when somebody's got it in their psyche?
Yeah. Yeah. So yeah, 100%.
You know, you follow, I understand you follow individuals like Brené Brown and Tim Tebow. How have these influencers in particular shaped your perspective on resilience, vulnerability, mental health?
Man, let me tell you, I'm a huge fan of, I love them both. Dr. Brené Brown has a special place in my heart because that was the first time I remember I was going through, so in 2019, my wife and I's 19-year marriage really hit rock bottom. It was like, okay, I was stripped completely bare emotionally and left with what direction do I go from right here, right now? Because in December 13th of 2019, I knew very clearly, like, Mike, you're the problem. Mike, you're literally the problem. Everything going on, man, you're the problem. And I remember I heard this brilliant quote, and I'm not smart enough to come up with it, but it said, you can blame or you can learn, but you can't do both. Mm-hmm. And up to that point,
I love that.
Up to that point, I had been blaming everybody and everything and circumstances and people and past history and experience. I'm like, man, I'm grabbing like all the, who can I listen to? Who can pour into me? And then I heard Brené Brown's TED Talk that she did several years ago that's had millions of views. And that was the first time I ever heard anybody talk about shame and vulnerability and the power that comes with that and how it, you know, it can unlock you. And I said, you know what? I think the answer here is I need to share these things because, again, understanding the culture of silence within law enforcement and first responders and military, I said, that's not the answer. I'm going to share this with, I'm going to be vulnerable and I'm going to be open. And then it's going to be people's choice on how they digest it and what they take from it. And so what I found was sharing these things and what I'd been through and what I had done and how I had hurt people and taking full accountability every single week in front of a room of 70 officers, because I was doing teaching at the time and I leveraged the teaching opportunity to share myself. That's where it all started. These officers were coming forward and going, man, hey man, I'm going through something. And they were waiting after class to have a discussion about it. And, so cool. I said, man, there's a need here. I don't know what it is, but we're going to do something here. And then that's what I started trying to define what wellness officer was. And anyways, to answer your question, because I know I like to, I'm a sage from the stage. I love to pontificate. But to answer your question, Brené Brown for me was just, it was the first time I ever heard somebody frame shame and vulnerability the way she did. And I went, that's it, man. I still listen to her TED Talks. I read her books. She's an excellent storyteller, which makes her just so incredibly powerful because it's the connectedness to and relatability of that she has. So that's how she's influenced me. And then Tim Tebow, I mean, you know, anybody who can get on their knees and give thanks, you know, to the man above in front of millions of people and just unabashedly own his spirituality. Like, how can you not love that? Because that's something that I had to do as well. Is, hey God, what's up, man? I'm tearing everybody up over here. Can you help me out? And he brought me to my knees. I mean, my relationship with God was the first thing I had to get right, and then everything else fell in line. Yeah,
stuff. Great. Thank you.
That's awesome. Yeah, thank you. Yeah. Sometimes we always look at the people at the end and we're trying to help them when it's almost, you almost have to go to the beginning and then in time hope that, like you said, that suicide rate drops from, you know, if we're focusing the 20 that's coming out the end of the pipe, we kind of almost have to go to the front and fix the front and then only maybe 10 come out the end of the pipe in 10 years from now. What advice would you give someone who's brand new in law enforcement, who's just coming in, and to help them maintain their mental health while facing all the challenges?
You know, it's interesting. That's a good question, because there's this big, there's a lot of discussion around retention and recruitment within law enforcement. And I hear a lot of, let me back up a little bit. When we look at the numbers and we really kind of deconstruct the numbers, because our organization takes about 37 metric points, if I remember correctly. And, you know, we look at years of service, we look at male, female, is there a service connection? And something that we have found consistently throughout the numbers is that it's about 15 to 16 years of service on the job where these suicides are happening. So what does that tell me? That tells me it's not an old guy problem. And that also tells me it's not a young guy problem, because what I hear a lot is a lot of blame. I hear the old veterans saying, man, these young guys, this generation, these snowflakes and millennials. And then I hear the young guys saying, man, these old salty dudes, they don't want to talk to us, you know. And it's like, okay, wait a second. How can we cross the bridge here? Because like it or not, the future of law enforcement is with a younger generation. So I think the answer to the question is have the conversation as soon as possible and as often and consistently as possible. My recommendation for the incoming law enforcement officers, incoming firefighters, is as quickly as you can, find who in the organization is doing it right. And then see how they're modeling the behavior, and are they showing up the way you want to show up in 15 or 20 years, but also be able to identify the people that are not living a whole life. And you want to talk to them as well and get ideas. But I would say as quickly as possible, identify who that is, seek for mental health resources, and don't be afraid to use them. Because according to Dr. Kevin Gilmartin in his book, Emotional Survival for Law Enforcement, Dr. Gilmartin says in the first 5 years, you're at a greatly increased risk of developing depression and anxiety. And looking at these men and women coming into the profession, and we are vetted so well. You've got to go through the MMPI, and you've got to go through polygraphs, and you've got to go through oral boards. You've got to go through interviews with people to get just to say you got the job. You are our guy, you're our girl. And we take that person, we send them to an academy, we get them physically fit, we empower them with all the knowledge and the book smarts and tactics and how to drive fast under all the things. And we take that same person, and 5 years down the road, they're a shell of themselves, they've gained weight, they're completely isolated, depressed, angry. And you go, well, what happened? Well, what happened is we're not putting any focus. I mean, so much training and emphasis is on pulling the gun out of the holster when statistically speaking, not that you won't, but the chances are very low that that's ever going to happen. And you're going to have to use your weapon in a felony encounter. Now, the risk is increased right now. I totally understand that, and I'm not minimizing it. But we know that this right here, every single day is being pulled out of the holster and it's being used. So why aren't we training it? Why aren't we training it? Mm. Why aren't we putting funds aside and putting people in classes and having conversations? And we as an organization, our flagship program, Responder Readiness, what we seek to do, because it is readiness, we're looking to get on the, we call it left of bang, if you're familiar with this concept, developed by Patrick Van Horn. They wrote a book called Left of Bang, and it's really a violence mitigation tactic. And the combat hunters in the United States Marine Corps, looking at the unconventional styles of OEF and OIF, developed this violence mitigate. They started saying, we need to start looking at behaviors before the thing happens, because law enforcement, military, very reactive forces, like, here's the bang, here's the thing. Now we're gonna respond. And it's a reactive approach. The problem with reactive approaches, when I look at it from the mental health perspective, after the suicide, after the officer-involved shooting, after the divorce, after the crisis, when I'm on the right side of the bang, now everything that I do is going to seem like a half-hearted effort. And you're going to hear a lot of men and women within the departments go, they don't care. It's just a checkbox, man. They really don't give a shit about us. So you got to get on the left side of it, and you got to create the conversation as early as possible. Be as open as possible. Look, here's what may or may not happen. Be ready for it. Some folks get in these career fields and do really well. They go 25, 30 years and they're resilient and they got great coping skills. Not everybody is like that though. And for me, I was like, we always have to plan for the, I hate this term, but the lowest common denominator. I got to plan for the possibility of the man or woman who cannot handle this job. I can't discard them. I trained them. I paid for the training. I've invested in them. I got to keep them. I want to keep them. They're part of this system. They belong here. And how can I create like acceptance, and how can I create all these like values and cultivate that through these early conversations? And so to answer your question, the conversation needs to be had day one, day 10, day 90, year 20. You need to have it consistently. It needs to be something that, again, your gun's part of the job. You know your police car's part of the job, the handcuffs, the defensive tactics. You also need to cultivate resiliency. They need to cultivate conversations and vulnerability and let folks know it's okay to not be okay.
I love this stuff, and you know how I feel about law enforcement, and I'm gonna bring up a little hot topic, I have a feeling it's gonna be a hot topic with you. But we heard a couple of years ago a term called defund the police. And how can we defund when we're average 10 to 12 officers, and we have these issues that require money? And thought, as a layperson, I don't understand that term. It was thrown around by a lot of people. From somebody in the process, can you talk about that hot term?
Yeah, I know. People said defund the police, and it was a super like kind of kitschy term, right? Let's defund the police. And then I think people saw really quickly what that actually looked like, because there were cities, even in Texas, that had legitimately had some defunding, like Austin right up the road. And I think they saw the crime rate spike, and they saw the violent crime rates go up. And I think really quickly people pulled back on that. Now, here, I'm going to say something also very unpopular. I didn't completely disagree with some people on the defund the police side. I'm very open-minded, and I'm willing to look at all different perspectives. And there were a handful of people that said, we need to defund these programs, and we need to fund the mental health programs. And I can get behind that, like, okay, cool. I don't need to do more flashlight training. So let's cut some of the fat off of these kind of training, and let's bring in some of the mental health stuff. But the whole idea of let's defund the police across the board, I thought it was ridiculous. I think 2023, if you look around the United States and just turn on the 6 o'clock news, clearly that narrative is still playing out in cities across America. And the other part of it, I don't think that small town America was saying defund the police. I think this was a large, sprawling urban departments with, where this is where you were hearing it. But I think if you went out and to the small 10 to 12 person agencies, they were saying, no. Those communities are saying we need every single one of these men and women. I just think it was ridiculous, and you're still seeing it play out to me in 2023. But yeah, I was like, cool. We there's some things that I think we could get in and probably let's reduce the budget a little bit. Let's take this money and let's put it into the mental health of our officers, because I believe it was Robert Kennedy said it's. In the 70s, but I got the quote. I know I'm getting the time frame wrong, but he said every community has the police force they deserve. And I thought, man, that is so interesting. Your community and the community's culture is gonna be reflective of the police force that is serving it. If the community believes we need to have the best officers, the most, you know, highly trained, we need to compensate them fairly, then you're going to see that support through the actions of the police officers. You're going to see good community policing. You're going to see engaged officers. You're going to see officers out in the communities taking care of the communities, doing the like small things. So I remember when I heard that, somebody told me that quote and I went, man, that's absolutely true. If your community is burning buildings down and, you know, picketing and they have the signs, then, get rid of the police, then expect the police force to be reflective of the mindset. And don't be surprised when it feels like things are falling apart. Right. Yeah. That's my thought on that.
That's perfect. You know, and another thing that I think people forget about, and this is something I know you're passionate about, you brought it up a little earlier, is the unsung heroes of police force, and that's marriages. Yeah. You know, that's the families in behind. And I know you've, you know, because there's a lot of intensity that's brought to the home, and sometimes that spouse or partner is not you know, equipped for that. And I'm going to throw myself under the bus a little bit. I'm going to make my partner extremely happy. But when I was doing a little background on you, I talked to a mutual friend, and he's like, I go, hey, what's some things I can ask Mike? And he's like, oh, you have to ask him about Leo and marriages. And I went, what? I go, I'm a Leo. I go, what does an astrological sign have anything to do with being a marriage? I go, I know as a Leo, you know, astrologically, we're all about, you know, being leaders and we're loyal and all that kind of stuff. But I go, I can't understand what being a Leo and a marriage has anything to do with it. And he goes, no, you dumbass. Leo stands for law enforcement officer. And I'm like,
oh.
All right. Well, you know what? You know, I'm from California where we live in like, you know, Hippieville and all that kind of shit. And he's like, yeah, you know, I'm a fucking Texan. And you know what? You're about the only Californian I like. So, you know, just and I got so much shit. He's like, yeah. So I had to throw myself on the bus and give our buddy Corey a little love because he just thought I was the biggest dumbass for thinking I was astrological sign and not, you know, law enforcement officer. So with that being said, I know you teach a marriage counseling class. Can you just talk about that? Because people don't think about bringing home the stress to the home.
Yeah, that's funny. I was like, man, what's he talking about? I'm a Scorpio, man. You know, but anyways, yeah. But I kind of felt like I knew where you were going with it. I was like, I think I know. But yeah, I mean, you know, if you look at relationships, like you want to have better officers, create better relationships. Again, going back to Dr. Kevin Gilmartin, he says, cool, in the first 5 years, you're at a greatly increased risk of developing depression and anxiety. But guess what else you're also doing in your first 5 years? You're getting married. You're buying houses. You're like, I got a career now. Now I can afford to do some of these things. That's another layer to this is like we're not equipping our men and women to be in relationship with their spouses. We're not equipping the spouses like, hey, here's some of the things you're going to see and you may be able to recognize. My wife and I do teach a marriage class. We were taught by a marital psychologist out in Colorado. We wanted to focus in on first responders. He told us, hey, y'all go ahead and do your thing because it wasn't, you know, he had a specific focus. And so we kind of took some of the things we've learned, most importantly, our experiences, and we developed our own class and we just started inviting responders. And every time we put this class out, you know, we have 10, 20 couples in the room that are just like, tell us what to do. Tell us how to be married and how to be in relationship. The divorce rates are, I've just seen this through various websites and stuff, like upwards of 80% for first-time marriages in law enforcement.
Wow.
I mean, the divorce rate for for marriages in America is 50%. And now you're adding the stress of the job. And so, yeah, it makes sense that it would be upwards of 80%. But another cultural nuance is, oh, you know, you're going to be divorced two or three times, and it's kind of an accepted part of the culture. And I said, man, look, why do we really get married? Well, I think without education, people don't realize that marriage actually refines and makes you better. It highlights your blind spots, makes you a overall more well-rounded human being. But we don't teach that. You know, if your marriage is struggling and you're having an affair and you're up to no good, guess what you're going to do? You're going to seek out other responders, other people who are living the same life. And then there's zero accountability across the board. Nobody's going, hey, Mike, what are you doing, man? You think it's a good idea to go see your girlfriend when your wife and kids are at home waiting for you? I mean, that's an incredibly uncomfortable conversation to have. And that's a conversation that I absolutely like, let's have it. Let's have a discussion about it. Let's be as open and honest and transparent. And when I bring my spouse in the room, then it's like, oh, wow, she's part of this too. And that's how that's what you got to do. You got to bring the spouses in. You got to invite them to the substation. You got to enmesh them in the culture of law enforcement from day one. This is not just about your responder. It's about the families too. And so you want your responders to be supported and to feel loved and accepted at home. How do you do that? And remove the shroud of secrecy. Because I remember my first, man, probably 10 years in law enforcement, my wife had zero clue about what I was doing at work. She wasn't there. She didn't know what roll call looked like. She didn't know what the inside of the substation looked like, the locker room, nothing. She had zero context of my job other than I was a cop. And I'm like, you need to bring the spouses in. We need to teach classes, bring them together. This is not like, let's train. Because if you put a bunch of responders in a room, you hand them a bunch of great materials and handouts, I already know what's going to happen. As soon as they walk out the door, if there's a trash can there, that's where the stuff is going too. And you got your spouse in there. Guess what? The spouse is going to say, go pick that, get that. I want to read that when I get home. Right. And then they're going to say, well, look what it says here, yeah, they're going to hold your feet to the fire. And that's what we need to do. We need to bring spouses into this as well and support the families, support the children. And the other thing, Doc, that drives me nuts is I hear so many responders when I do training. I go, how many of you want your children to be cops, firefighters? You know what they all say? Hell no. No way, man. I don't want them to do this job. My challenge to our responders is, hell yes, I want you to do this job. Who better? You're vetted. I raised you. You got the same values I possess, you also possess. Like, who better to fill my shoes than you? This used to be a generational profession. I would love to get back there where, the men and women currently serving have their children and then their children. But I have a 12-year-old and he's told me, I want to be a police officer. I don't discourage him. I don't discourage him. But what I promised myself when I was still serving was I wanted to hand him a department better than when I got it. So that when he gets on, I know he's got the support. And I know that his wife and his children are going to be taken care of. And he's going to be supported all the way through his career, his wife, his children, everybody. It needs to be a holistic approach. I know.
Love that.
Yeah.
Mike, we are going to switch gears and do one of our favorite sections of our program called the rapid fire questions. There's five of them. Now, this is going to be a real challenge for you, not to come up with the answer, but to come up with the little answer that we're looking forward to hear. Are you prepared for this? Ready?
I think somewhat, yes.
All right, here we go. Rapid fire. Question number one is, you run a marriage retreat. What is one piece of advice you feel everyone married should follow immediately?
Oh my God. One piece of marriage advice. Commit to covenantal language with your spouse. This is you're in it for the long haul.
Commit to what was the word?
Covenantal language, promissory language. That is, quit using the word divorce as an option. I'm in it. I'm with you. We're gonna see this through. If you're not willing to quit your career, you shouldn't be willing to quit your marriage. Why are you so willing to serve for 25 years? I need the same level of commitment and promise to your relationship.
Wow, that was powerful. All right. Question number two. If there is one thing that you could change in today's society, what would it be?
Our unwillingness to be honest with one another.
Good. Good. Question number three. What is your favorite movie and why?
Oh, man. What? My favorite movie? My favorite movie and why? Oh, my gosh. I'm looking at my DVDs. Yes, I still have DVDs. You know, I would say a movie that kind of consistently makes me like really emotional is A River Runs Through It. I absolutely love that movie. I love the story of the brothers living in Montana, and I love oh my gosh, what is his name? The father. He's a preacher, but I just love the interaction and the family dynamic. That movie, if it's on, I'm watching it. I love that movie.
Great. It's about the relationships. I like that.
Absolutely.
Well, if you thought the favorite movie question was challenging, how about this one? Craziest thing that you've done naked.
Craziest thing that I have done naked. Wow. My wife's not going to watch this. No, I'm kidding. Oh my goodness. Okay. When I was in the Air Force, and anybody who's been in the Air Force and has gone through SEER school, probably understands, the craziest thing I did was, use the restroom, on the side of a mountain, on a little rock, just to have a little bit of alone time and peace. I purposely kind of went like hid, and it was really unsafe, but it was one of the most beautiful views I'd ever had. I was completely alone, but I also had zero. I had no pants on, and I just wanted. I remember thinking I wanted to just feel. I wanted to feel the earth. I wanted some connected. I don't know.
That's awesome.
That sticks out in my mind.
That might be one of the better answers I've heard in a while.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, you're going to enjoy question number five, the last one. We've heard from veterans of the Marines and Army who say that their Air Force are the country club of the military. What would your response to them be?
They're right. Hey, you. Let me tell you a story. Let me tell you a quick little story. We were. I'll tell you, being a loadmaster on the seat and on that airframe, we were out at the bird 8 hours before the rest of the crew load. It was a hard job. It did have some really tremendous benefits, but let me tell you. So we stayed. We flew into Hickam Air Force Base because coming from the Pacific missions, you would stop it in Hickam, Hawaii. That was the first C-5 base. So any kind of like major maintenance issues, that's where you stop. So we would always break down in Hawaii. And it wasn't that was purposeful. It's just if you had things that broke in Guam, they couldn't fix it. You had to limp it back to Hickam. So there was one unfortunate time where we had to actually stay in base housing on base. And I'll never forget it. I was, three-stripe senior airman, and I was up. We were all along the top of they called it VOQ, the visiting officers' quarters. And we walked in to our rooms, and everybody had their own room. And from down the hall, I hear, this is bullshit. Get your shit. And I walked out and I went, oh, it was the aircraft commander down at the end of the hall. And he says, everybody get your bags. And he called the crew, get in the crew bus. They called the crew bus, came, picked us up. And I was like, man, what is going on? The air conditioner wasn't turned on for us. We're out of here. Then we went and they got, yeah, I'm not even making this up. They got, and so they got the government rate approval, like off base. And we went and stayed on in downtown Honolulu. Yeah, on the strip. That I laugh at that story because I'll never forget it. I was like, oh my God, you know, this guy. And we had big crews on the C5. It was, you know, a dozen, 13, 14 people. And we all, and the air conditioner wasn't on. I was like, for the love of God, what is.
So it's better than a country club.
It was. I'll tell you, man, my time in the military, I loved serving. I used to love going down range and picking these men and women up, these operators and different units. And I was just like, my job was so awesome. Being able to fly on that airframe and tour people around it and meet all the different folks. And I met some amazing people in my time in the military. Yeah. That's cool. Yeah.
That's awesome. I'm going to throw this out really quick. Did you ever know a pilot by the name of who flew that plane? He actually flew George Bush's plane a lot, bunch of times, named Henry Fairclough. Mm-mm. Or Hank.
Mm-mm.
All right. I just threw that. He's one of my best friends, and he finally retired as a colonel, but he flew the big boys, and he flew a lot of time the presidential thing back to Germany.
Oh, wow. Like so he probably flew Air Force One.
He didn't fly Air Force One. He flew all the C-17s or C-130s, whatever. He flew all like his Jeeps and his cars and all that.
Yeah.
And he would fly that.
Yeah.
So he was, and they also flew for Special Forces.
Yeah.
So I said no.
Yeah. Very, very kind of similar thing that we did. So anyway, don't know him.
Yeah. That's why I throwing that out there. Anyway, talk a little bit about this going back, talk a little bit about this first help and what they do.
So first help, HELP being H-E-L-P is an acronym for Honor, Educate, Lead, and Prevent. What the organization is really best known for is their suicide database. I mean, we're known nationally. If people want to see like what are the numbers look like, what are the trends, they go to our organization. That organization was founded by Karen Solomon in 2016. Shout out Karen Solomon. I absolutely love her. But a big part of what the organization does is supporting the families post-suicide, because so many organizations don't know what to do with the families. Like, how do we support them? Or they may overpromise support and say things like, we're always going to be here. We're never going to leave your side. And by no fault of their own, I mean, you know, support falls off or people are uncomfortable with it. Our organization's commitment to the families is to continue to be that consistent support and to surround them with other folks who have been through similar situations so that they always feel like they're supported and they belong and that they're part of a very unique group of folks. And we continue to honor the lives of the responders because really that's what it's all about, is honoring the lives lived, not the manner in which they died necessarily. A lot of people have a lot of problem with suicide and that manner of death. And I'm like, look, before they came to this, they were fathers and husbands and they were great police officers. They were members of the military. They did all these amazing things. That's where we need the space in which we need to be. Education, the E is through responder readiness. That is our flagship course that really, like I said, it seeks to get on the left side of the crisis and have open, honest discussion and dialogue. We leave them with resilience skills. We call it the range of resilience. 5 easy to use resilience, everyday resilience skills. We give them a results oriented communication, which is just a framework for being able to talk, because we suck at talking to one another. We're like no good at it. And, you know, because we don't know how to facilitate the conversation. So we say, hey, here's an idea of how you might be able to do that. We're developing a family readiness program. We have a supervisor readiness program because we do believe in also creating ready leaders. And we teach like the well-being theory, Dr. Martin Seligman and the PERMA model. And we kind of walk them through creating like positive relationships and being able to engage their subordinates, but more importantly, like being able to engage themselves as leaders so that they're leading from the right place. And then the L lead, we want to try and be as involved as possible at the national, state, and local levels in meaningful, sustainable legislation that seeks to help and remove the stigma, you know, because Karen Solomon, for example, was directly involved in getting the public safety officer bill passed earlier. It was last year. She was directly involved with those conversations. There's state to state. There's not continuity. And I would love to see some continuity in legislation, but that's our job. Like, we're advocates. You all are advocates. Everybody can petition their legislatures. Hey, this is what we need to do to support these folks. That's, you know, our elected officials are put in office for that reason. So we need to leverage them, you know, and bring them to our side because they have the power ultimately. And then the P prevention is our database. How do we prove there's a problem? Well, you got to have numbers. I mean, that's across the board in any job. If people say, well, there's this problem, they say, prove it to me. Show me. Well, cool. Here's the numbers, right? We keep metrics on everything in law enforcement, the crime rate. We constantly have statistics. We're very statistically driven. Well, here's the suicides. There's a problem. And also just as a side note, the law enforcement suicide data collection by the FBI is another place. They're also capturing suicide data as well for law enforcement. But I will tell you, last year, for example, they captured about 44 suicides for law enforcement. Our organization captured 175. So your first responders in your audience, if they know there was a suicide within their organization, go to our website. Put it on there. Somebody from the organization will contact them and vet it and get additional information, but also go to the FBI's suicide data collection, because when the FBI goes in empowered with numbers, guess who listens? The legislatures, the federal government. Right now, they're preparing their report that shows, you know, 44 officers died by suicide last year. There are some people that might say, doesn't seem like there's a problem. And we know that there absolutely is. So I recommend anybody in your audience, like, go to our website, firsthelp.org/the numbers. Take a look. It's interactive. You can kind of play around with the numbers. And if you know somebody in your agency has died by suicide, also go to the FBI's data collection and put it in there as well, because it's critically important that we raise as much awareness as possible. So that's a little bit about First Help and what we do and what they're all about. Incredible organization.
Thanks, Mike. We're going to wrap up with this last question that has a couple parts to it. And it's, you know, we also understand you pretty much described yourself as just a regular guy, but man, there ain't nothing regular about what you do and what you've experienced and what your motivation is. And we really appreciate that. Could you please tell us, you know, what is it that drives you, and how do you maintain that emotional, that resilience to bounce back and be as charming and motivating as you are? And, you know,
yeah.
And that we'll close with.
Yeah. Well, thank you. You know, I never consider myself a charming person. This guy, you know, I tell everybody, Doc, this guy every day is a choice. This guy, this verse, people, some people call me Happy Mike or man, Mike always seems. And I said, man, this guy is a choice. I got to get up every day and choose to be this guy. How do I do that? Well, I do meditative practices in the morning. I spend time with God in the morning. I would never ask anybody to do something that I'm unwilling to do myself. Sometimes I have to spend time with my wife and own some of the things that I screwed up because I don't always get it right. Those are some of the ways I got to take care of myself in order, good in, good out. Like, the only way I'm going to be good to anybody is if I practice what I preach and I'm willing to take my own advice and sit down every single day and, have discussions with me, because there are some days where I wake up and I feel angry, or I feel inadequate, or I feel outside of myself. And I feel like, man, I don't belong here. Why am I doing what I'm doing? And why would people ever want to listen to what I'm saying? When those things happen, I have to go back a little bit and spend a little bit of time with, you know, little Mike, adolescent Mike, teenage Mike, young adult Mike. And I have to spend time healing that guy, putting my arm around him and saying, hey, man, look at all you've done. You're 40, 42. People love you. You love life. And I have to spend a little time healing that guy. But those are some of the ways that I have to keep myself healthy in order to be able to support the population and the people that I love. You know, you can't pour from an empty cup is the old saying. And so I'm constantly just trying to fill myself with things that make me a better human being. Yeah.
Oh, I appreciate that. We appreciate that. The audience, you know, that's what gives them the juice to move on to the next moment, the next day, especially when they're afflicted with challenges. So
yes,
thank you for sharing that. And I definitely felt that moment when you share about what you feel personally, even the negative stuff, a connection, because, you know, we can't wake up every day feeling like a rock star. And, you know, sometimes we have those days and it's just a matter of spending 90% or 95% of your life in a positive mindset,
yeah,
at least, you know, because some of that negative shit gets in, yeah, there. So thank you so much.
Absolutely. Absolutely. It's a pleasure being with you all today. Truly.
Thanks, Mike.
Pleasure's all ours. You have a blessed day.
You all too. Be safe.
Thanks.
Thank you for listening to today's episode of the Crackin' Backs podcast. We hope you enjoyed, and make sure you follow our Instagram at Crackin' Backs podcast. Catch new episodes every Monday. See you next time.